As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
7 years ago, if I tried to talk about Formula One on this program, Tom would have said, what are you doing? What are you doing with Formula One? What's Formula One all about?
Exactly.
Back in 2015, the former F1 boss Bernie Eccleston had this to say to ESPN. He said, we ought to try to break America, but it's hard for me because I'm not very enthusiastic about the country. It's difficult because they are sort of isolated. They are a big island and they are slowly starting to learn about what other people in the world do. Well, Mr. Eccleston was wrong. It seems the United States has learned quickly following the sale of Formula One to US-based Liberty Media, and with the help of Netflix's Drive to Survive series. Look at the TV audience here, Tom. Average race viewership in the US has gone from about 500,000 back in 2017.
Where was it yesterday?
To 1.2 million last year.
Where was it yesterday?
Probably bigger.
The fifth season.
Probably bigger.
This is a joy now. Christian Horner to join us, and of course, Mr. Farrell will lead this with legit knowledge on Formula One. But all I can say is what is so dominant here, and is it's a safe-free zone for Manchester United this morning. Bloomberg Surveillance is a safe free zone for everybody in Formula One that got their clocks cleaned yesterday.
Just ridiculous dominance, Tom. Absolutely. Christian Horner, the team principal of Red Bull Racing F1, joins us right now. Christian, congratulations on the win over the weekend. And let's start there. What goes into it over the winter to turn up in race one and absolutely dominate the way you did?
Well, first of all, thanks very much. I mean, it was a great start for us yesterday. And the regulations, they're constantly being tuned and evolving. But the basis of the car is similar to the 2022 regs. So the team have done a great job in evolving the car and evolving every single detail. Almost every component is new for this year. And with only 3 days of practicing, of testing, it was great to get that first big score in yesterday with a 1-2 finish.
Christian, we've all heard about the rule changes in the last 18 months. It was meant to make it more competitive. And I think a lot of people over the weekend might be looking at the front two and saying, what happened? What is it about this setup, these rule changes, that you think suits you and the team so well?
I think we've only run the cars at this track in Bahrain. We tested there and we raced there, and it certainly suited our car, incredibly well. But, the Formula One calendar is 23 different races, 23 different circuits, different asphalts, different conditions. And the big question is that kind of performance going to carry over into the different variants of circuits that we have? So it's going to take two or three races. I know a lot of people are saying, Red Bull are going to run away with it. But, we're certainly not thinking like that. And we need to see a few more races to see how things pan out.
Christian, we started this conversation by talking about the changes we've seen in your sport, the attention it now gets from the rest of the world. Can you give us a flavor of that, just how maybe some of the nature and the size of the sponsorship deals have adapted, changed, increased over the last couple of years?
Well, look, we've seen massive growth. I think that the whole phenomenon through Drive to Survive has just introduced Formula One to a whole new audience, a younger audience, and very much an American audience. So I think out of the 25 new partners that we've introduced in the last 3 years, 21 of them are US-based, and three of them are in the Fortune 500. It's just, Formula One is on fire at the moment. And what Drive to Survive has done is it's done a great job of explaining the sport and bringing a new fan base in, a young fan base, a female fan base as well. Shown some of the characters and some of the competition. that goes on behind the scenes. So it's a bit like, you know, the Kardashians on wheels at times.
Chris, and I'm sure that's Salin in a big way. Does that work for you, Tom, the Kardashians on wheels?
I can see that.
Is that
right?
What you're interested in?
I can see that on the side of Max's car, Kardashians
on
wheels.
I'm not sure Max would go with that. Christian, there are some hardcore fans, if you will, that are disappointed by some of the new tracks, including last year in Florida. Is there a risk that we sacrifice track and race quality for commercial and geographic expansion?
Well, I don't think so. I think you've got to protect, you know, the old circuits like the Monacos and the Silverstones and the Monzas. But then to bring in new circuits, I mean, we have Miami last year as a new venue. This year we got Las Vegas, and I have never seen hype around a race like that. I think it's going to be the biggest sporting event on the globe this year. And, you know, the demand for that race is off the chart. So, of course, you know, the commercial demand for the sport is at an all-time high with 23 races at 23 different venues around the world. So, you know, there's a mixture of street tracks and some of the old classic circuits. So I think it does cater for everything.
Christian, unlike some of the owners and the elites of Formula One, you've actually raced the cars. I'm fascinated what you think about the expansion to four more cars within Formula One. I know a $600 million buy-in is out there. To me, that seems low. But can the track take four more cars in that first dangerous turn?
I think the tracks are certified to be able to take more cars. I think it boils down to the practicalities. You mentioned an entry criteria, and of course the commercials, like in any business, are going to drive the decision making. You know, on this, effectively you've got a 10 franchise set up at the moment that have their value through the exclusivity of those 10 franchises. And I think Liberty are keen to protect that as the custodians and the owner of the commercial rights holder. The FIA, the regulator, obviously they're looking to see, you know, can more teams be accommodated? And so inevitably there'll need to be a compromise found at some point. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to who pays for it.
Christian, you were talking about expanding to the U.S. and that things won't be sacrificed, but with the nature of the sponsors and the nature of the audience, which target audience are you going after? Is Formula One going after in the United States?
Well, we're bringing in a young audience, and we've signed up so many partners, you know, recently, like Oracle and Hard Rock and Rocks and Cash App and so on. And of course, the big announcement for us last month was the announcement with Ford for 2026 on our powertrain. And we're looking to appeal to a younger demographic. Red Bull is an edgy team. We've got drivers that push the boundaries. We're a team that pushes the boundaries, and our following in the U.S. is bigger than any other team, and I think it's only a matter of time in future years that an American driver will be running at the front in Formula One, and again we want to be at the forefront of that. So we're looking to make sure that we protect the diehard fans, but that we attract a new audience, a younger audience, and a more diverse audience into the sport.
Christian, that's going to mean cheaper tickets, maybe. I was just looking at some of the prices in Vegas. It was cheaper for some of us on the East Coast, I think, just to fly to Europe to go to Silverstone, Christian, than try and get a ticket at some of the tracks here in the United States. What can be done about that?
Well, look, I think it's, again, it's supply and demand, isn't it? And the demand for Vegas is just off the charts. Anybody that's anyone is going to be at that weekend. I think it's going to be the most watched sporting venue, as I say, of the year. But we do need to look after the fans. We need to have a sensible, entry price that fans can come and see a Grand Prix, can see these incredible cars. Because until you see it live, you can't comprehend the speed of these machines and what, a human being is actually able to control around the streets, for example, of Las Vegas. So, that's a responsibility that we as teams and the commercial rights holder have to protect and look after, the diehard fans.
Christian, you mentioned Ford. They're going to have a role in the speed of Red Bull Racing in a few years' time. Can you just discuss the risks around a new relationship with a new partner and when the planning really begins?
Well, you know, for 2026, it's new regulations for a new engine. And we as Red Bull decided to take on that challenge ourselves as an independent, you know, as a subsidiary of an energy drinks manufacturer, taking on Mercedes and Ferrari and now Audi and Renault and so on. So we felt that it was right for us to align ourselves with a manufacturer to give us you know, access to some of the R&D that they're investing, for example, in electrification. And discussing with you know, Jim Farley from Ford and Bill Ford, they were looking at Formula One, and therefore, you know, a partnership with Red Bull was a very natural thing on both sides to do. And you know, we're going to benefit from their knowledge and their technical know-how in you know, certainly in the electrification. And you know, with that process has started already, because 2026, as far as the engine's concerned, is literally tomorrow.
Christian, I want to bring up someone else over the weekend. I think you joked that there were three Red Bulls on the podium over the weekend. Number three was the Aston Martin of Fernando Alonso. Christian, you've been in a car before. Can you describe how crazy it is what Fernando Alonso is doing in his early 40s?
Well, look, I mean, Fernando is a fantastic driver. He's, you know, one of the best of all time. And he's finally got himself in a competitive car. And at 41 years of age, he's giving all the 40-somethings something to root for. And he's showed yesterday he's lost none of that racing spirit or drive or determination or skill. And, you know, he's in great shape. And he's going to be a competitive you know, driver and team this year for us, and we've got to, you know, very much keep an eye on them, because I think they could be the dark horse of this championship.
Well, I was hoping that you'd say Ferrari, but maybe it's going to be Aston Martin. TK Ferrari just not getting it done,
get it
over
done
the weekend
yesterday.
At all. Christian, congratulations on a dominant race weekend. I hope we can do this again soon, and please come to the studio here in New York when you make it over to the States. Christian Horner there of Red Bull Racing.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Right now, leadership from James Bianco. Jim Bianco is founder and president of Bianco Research. Jim, I'm thrilled to have you on here on a hallmark day of 3-month LIBOR at 5%. What does that signal to you?
That short rates are going to keep going higher, that the Fed at a minimum is going to be higher for longer. And the aggressive call right now is that they're going to move maybe 75 or another 100 basis points, and we could be talking about a 6 handle before the end of the year on the funds rate. But short rates are going to keep going up. And that, I think, is the big driver of why the yield curve has become a new record inversion, because it's all been driven by the long end. When the 10-year rallies, we get record inversions. When the 10-year rises in yields, we get some flattening of the yield curve, or maybe less inversion of the yield curve. And I think that that story is going to continue with the bond market.
Jim, do you expect Chairman Powell will be reluctant to lean into that argument, given we're still waiting for payrolls Friday and CPI next week?
No, I don't think he will. I think that, you know, the data, you're right. I heard you before saying, you know, it's just 1 month of data and it's all been very, very strong. But the arc of data that we've seen over the last several months has not been weak. It has not been what Elizabeth Warren, a senator from Massachusetts, has been calling, you know, millions of people losing their jobs. It hasn't happened. Maybe it does, but it hasn't happened yet. And a lot of people thought it would have happened by now. So I think he's probably going to stay with the more aggressive move, that the Fed is going to continue to go at least a 2 or 3 more rate hikes. And if you're right, if the payroll data is strong or if the CPI data is strong, that we'll be talking about 50 for the March meeting. Right now, the market's putting about a 30% chance that the Fed will go 50 basis points at the March meeting. It wouldn't take much to push that over 50% and get people talking about it with a strong payroll number or CPI next week.
And the potential for short-term rates to go even higher is the reason why we've been talking all morning about this inversion, this yield curve inversion, the 210 spread, the most inverted going back to 1981. Some people are dismissing this and saying, you can't read too much into it. Other people are saying historically it has been one of the best indicators of recession to come. What is the correct read on this, Jim?
That a yield curve inversion is a forward indicator of recession, but more inversion does not mean a faster or harder recession than less inversion. It's a binary thing. Once you go inverted, you should be looking for a recession. Now, the thing about the yield curve is it can lead as much as 18 months before you eventually have that recession. That would put you in the first or second quarter of next year. And I think that the whole narrative around the recession, that a lot of people don't have that kind of patience. They think that the slowdown is going to happen in the next couple of months, as opposed to an early 24 story. So yes, the yield curve is a very powerful signal that we might be seeing a very big slowdown in the economy, but just because it's inverting more does not mean it's going to be worse, and it could still be up to a year away.
Do you think that based on that, and based on the readjustment that we've seen in markets for the past 4 months, do you think that there is a position that seems obviously crowded amid all of this uncertainty?
Oh, that's a good one right now. I think that if there isn't a position that is very crowded in the bond market, it's definitely, higher short rates, that you've seen a lot of speculative positions and a lot of people lining up to basically make a bet that short-term interest rates, the two-year note, the LIBOR, the Fed funds rate or whatever, is going to continue to go higher. Now, the thing about those kind of overcrowded trades is those are less market driven and more Federal Reserve policy driven type of trades. So they can be right at times. Other than that, if you want to look for crowded trades, I'd have to, meander outside of interest rates and maybe say the reopening in China is probably on my radar as being the biggest crowded trade that we're seeing right now. Everybody's in on that trade. And with the idea that they're only pushing 5% growth for this year was a bit of a disappointment for that trade.
Jim, are you suggesting we may have seen the reopening trade play out already?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, reopening, yes, the economy is going to reopen. It's going to be stronger than it was. But this whole idea that it's going to be rip-roaring in China, that they are going to produce a ton of stuff, put it on cargo ships, send it to the U.S., and collapse goods inflation in the U.S., I think that trade is a little bit overdone right now, and there's really no evidence that any of that is going to come to pass.
Jim, wonderful to catch up with you, to get your thoughts. As always, looking forward to hearing more from you through the week. The Federal Reserve Chair used the phrase in the last couple of months. He said the disinflationary process has started, and our next guest had something to say about that. David Leibovitz, global market strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management. David, I remember you saying it, your words. You said that phrase might go on the shelf with transitory. Has that gone on the shelf with transitory?
I think it has. I mean, when you look at the data that's come out so far this year, whether you look at the hard data being the jobs numbers, whether you look at the soft data, I mean, the survey data for February was very robust. This is clearly an economy that's proving to be more resilient than a lot of people expected. And I'm not sure that that disinflation the market was really grabbing onto at the start of the year is necessarily going to come through. I mean, particularly when you look at where job growth has been most robust, where wage growth has been most robust, it's in leisure and hospitality. It's in the service sector more broadly. And the reality is that services are not really showing any signs
of
slowing
down.
Don't
talk down to leisure and hospitality. That's what we're doing right here. We're leisure and hospitality. I mean, that's what we do at Bloomberg Surveillance every day. You're in the calm, patient, long-term business. What do you say to JP Morgan clients in a panic about the people that say not only we're going to drop, but we're going to drop at some point precipitously?
So I think the first point that we've been trying to make to people is that a lot of folks are suffering from recency bias, right? When they start to get agitated, they immediately think about one of two things. They either think about 2020 or they think about 2008. Statistically, those are very much outliers. And so when we look at the fundamental data, when we look at, say, the cyclical sectors of the economy, we don't really see anything that is so far off sides that it suggests an outsized downturn when one does materialize. And so I think what we've been trying to lean on is, you know, look, this economy has more momentum. And yes, that has implications for inflation. But if the Fed decides to crash the ship at some point down the road, we don't really see the pieces in place the way that they were, say, in 07 and 08 with respect to housing, and certainly don't foresee another global pandemic coming anytime
soon.
What
would it take for the Fed to crash this party?
So I think, you know, the one thing that we've been spending a lot of time thinking about is that at the end of the day, this is really an exercise in central banks and the Fed in particular defending their credibility. I mean, the Fed can get inflation to wherever they want it to be. They can get growth to wherever they want it to be. The question is what needs to happen to rates, and more specifically, what does the terminal rate actually look like? If this is a more inflationary economy, what that means is that R star isn't 2.5%. It's probably somewhere higher, and that has implications for what the Fed needs to do in order to snuff this inflation candle out. And so to me, the worst case scenario is a Fed that gets very frustrated with their inability, seeming inability, to get inflation back into check, and they keep hiking and hiking and hiking and throw that whole theory about leads and lags and it takes time for this to work its way through the economy very much into the wind. That's the big risk to the economy this year.
So how do you game out that risk in your investing? Because right now you're talking about perhaps we're not going back to another 2007, 2008 kind of crisis. So if you see resilience, that could be good for stocks, not necessarily bad, unless there is that downside. Risk.
Well, I think it's good short term. And I think that a lot of the concerns about profits are going to collapse by 30% that we've talked about together over the past couple of months, that's not necessarily going to come to fruition if the economy is still humming along and inflation is taking longer to come down. So I do think that near term, there is an opportunity in risk, and risk could certainly end up performing well again in the short run. I think that the challenge is, you know, how do you get inflation back in the bottle? Well, you reduce demand. And at some point that shows up in corporate revenues and corporate profits. And when earnings begin to really fall apart, that to me is what's going to lead the market back down, not necessarily to a new low, but perhaps the levels that we saw back in October and June of last year.
Do you see evidence that earnings are quote unquote falling apart?
So I think that earnings estimates are coming back down to earth, and I think that that's a good thing. You know, the 2023 number is down, call it 7-8% so far year to date. The challenge is when you think about what the market price is off of a forward multiple. So every day that we go through in 2023, we're picking up a year of average earnings in 2024, because those estimates certainly don't reflect
reality. Where's that statistic right now? Where's the multiple forward right now?
So the forward multiple is about 17.5-18 times today. You know, we think that's about two turns expensive relative where it should be. And furthermore, it's really a question about 2024 earnings, because everybody was talking about how this was going to be a year where profits came under pressure. But if the economy is proving to more resilient, that story is getting shifted down the road. And I'm not sure that markets necessarily appreciate that. And I certainly don't think that it's in the price.
So what do you do with a frenzy of tech priced out of 22, 25? Some of it's growthy, some of it's less profitable. But there's a lot of cash flow generators there as well. Are they worth that premium off 17 and 18?
So I don't think that they're there quite yet. I don't think that they're necessarily worth it yet. The reason why is that when we look around the markets today, there are plenty of other interesting things to do. I mean, the layup continues
to be. But are
they
value traps? This is the key question. Is John Deere or whatever trading at 9, 10, 12 times earnings, are they value traps where they sit there forever?
I only think that they're value traps if the Fed returns to zero, and I don't think that the Fed is returning to zero. I think my base case assumption is that there's going to be some sort of cost of capital in the market going forward, and that's going to make equities less about one thing, i.e., you know, mega cap, long duration growth, and a bit more balanced like we saw in the past. I actually think businesses that can generate productivity are going to be the ones that perform best in this environment, because investors aren't going to reward earnings growth simply that is a function of rising prices, right? They want to see business plans changing, and that's going to make or break investments going forward.
You say value traps, and I just think Europe. And then it feels like something's changed. Yet today, European banks, David, they're flying.
What's that about?
So I think part of it is the sigh of relief trade. I mean, it's been, what, a decade since the Eurozone crisis, and Europe finally seems to be kind of shaking off its scabs and coming back into the limelight. I think part of it might be a very long overdue dead cat bounce. I also think generally there's an expectation getting baked into that market that the ECB is going to have to do more. And like the Fed, when the ECB pauses, it's going to be a pause. They're not going to turn around and cut. Generally speaking, that's just a healthier environment for the banks. And furthermore, the European banks are very different today than they were in 07 and 08, seeing much better behavior is the way I would categorize it.
What's that Disney line you use, Tom? A whole new world.
It's a whole new world.
That's from Aladdin.
That's great.
It's a song. You've never saw
da, da,
Disney.
Da, da, da.
Yeah, I know, but you never, did you ever see it?
Why would I refer to it if I didn't know what movie it was about?
Well, I don't know. I thought maybe you were just saying it's a Disney song. It sounds like it. You know, he goes off on
this. Aladdin? Forget it. David, thank you. David Leibovitz of JP Morgan.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Ellen Wald, let's get serious here on China and 5%. Will that drive oil up $10 a barrel?
You know, it could. I think what we're seeing with China is that consumer demand is returning. Industrial demand is not returning as quickly. And so we're still in this kind of slower climb up. I remember when they started the reopening and everyone was anticipating this huge surge in oil demand. And I said, well, I don't know if it's going to happen quite as fast as we saw in the Western economies. I think it's going to be more of a slow climb up. And the question is really, when is that going to start hitting? And it does seem like now the consensus is not till H2. And that's when we're going to see, you know, $100 oil potentially. Of course, you know, that hits right in the middle of the summer and potentially very high temperatures and lots of driving demand, especially in the U.S. So I do think that that's really more of where we're looking at in terms of a surge in oil prices. And of course, you know, everyone who's predicted high oil prices, you know, we've seen oil jump up and then go back down on recessionary fears. So I do think we're headed more in an upward trend, but there's always that potential for things to kind of wobble.
One of the most notable sort of trends over the past couple of months, Ellen, is the number of people who have just abandoned calls for $100 oil and saying, actually, you know what? It's never going to come back. This is basically where we're going to stay. I mean, it feels like the market's a bit of a child who's basically all or nothing sometimes, at least for the past couple of months. Do you get the sense that that is becoming one of the main themes, the dominant themes that you keep hearing from the people you talk with?
Yeah, I do think that we are seeing on the whole people kind of walking back their predictions. I remember at the end of 2022, we kept seeing, you know, these incredible predictions. Oil is going to be 120, 130 in 2023. And now we're seeing revisions down to, well, maybe we might hit $100 a barrel. I do think that we are headed in general towards a period of tightness, of a supply being more of a concern. I do think that there is potential in certain areas to increase supply to meet that that demand. That the place is not necessarily the United States, though. I don't think we can depend on U.S. producers to ramp up production as much as we have in the past, and that is something that is not necessarily being reflected in the forecast we're seeing from, say, the EIA. I do think Saudi Arabia and UAE have potential. There's also potential from Iraq. And I do think that if things get really tight, we will see OPEC moving to increase their quotas, but maybe not really until June, July, or even August.
Some people say that stockpiles have gone up and that the price has remained relatively low relative to expectations because of the increase in electric vehicle usage. Do you buy into this idea?
No. I do not. Okay. I think definitely we're seeing more people buy electric vehicles, but I don't think that these are these are a main driver in stockpiles, because electric vehicles are still limited in their range. And when you look at big driving, I mean it's not people driving an electric vehicle, 20 miles to, do some errands around town. So I really don't think we're seeing that bite. I think, if you really want to look at the big drivers in demand, we're talking about China and India. And these are not places where electric vehicles are necessarily having a huge impact. I know it looks like a big increase, because when you're starting from very little and you get an increase, it's very big. But, for every EV that's sold, how many, internal combustion engine cars are still on the road and still being driven? So I don't think that is cutting demand in the places where demand is really increasing all that much. I do think that they are definitely growing in interest, but I think that there is a limit to how beneficial they are, given how range-bound a lot of these vehicles are.
Looking forward to Jeddah with you. Alan Walt, the brilliant Alan Walt of the Atlantic Council, thank you.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.